First up today, Union Station. The grand old train station turned 100 this year, and the fact that it survived a century and is still with us is something of a miracle. In fact, if it wasn't for the flood of 1903, city leaders probably wouldn't have placed the station where it is today. Jeff Spivak wrote a history of Union Station that came out a few years ago, and he'll be speaking at the library on Sunday afternoon. Jeff Spivak is a senior market analyst at Black & Veatch. He spent more than 23 years as a civic affairs reporter for the Kansas City Star. And Jeff, nice to have you. Good morning.
Thanks.
Well, I wanted to begin where you began your book on the history of Union Station, Jeff, and that's with a letter you received as you were working on the book that was filled with wobbly handwriting. You got this letter as you were just finishing up the book, and what struck me about it was that it said so much about this train station and what it meant to so many people over the years. Tell us about that letter.
Well, that was a letter from Gladys Watkins.
There you go.
And she was in her 90s.
Yeah.
And we got, you have to understand that back as Union Station was getting redeveloped in the mid-90s and the bi-state vote in 1995 or 6, and people kind of came out of the woodwork to, you know, express their support for, you know, getting Union Station kind of reopened. And there were people that sent me letters and others at the Star who went back all the way to the opening, grand opening in 1914. Gladys wasn't really that old, but she was one of a number of people that were in their 80s and 90s and basically were from a rural area. And so coming to Kansas City and seeing Union Station was kind of like going to New York City.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Seeing the Empire State Building.
It was a coming of age moment for, and Gladys had never been outside of her little rural Missouri town, I don't think.
And there were several people like that. And
yeah.
So the first time coming to Kansas City, and the first building you see is Union Station, and you walk in and the ceiling is 100 feet high and the building itself is monumental. It's, you know, it's sort of like the immigrants and the Statue of Liberty. And
she wrote in that letter to you that she will never, ever forget that moment. That moment, here it was all these decades later, and she was describing it in such great detail to you.
Absolutely. And but people like that who had all over the city had moments like that at Union Station, whether it was coming in and seeing the city for the first time, coming off, you know, rural areas, going off to war, coming back from war and World War II, you know, saying goodbye to loved ones, seeing a loved one come back from the war, seeing, you know, kind of going off to college, you know, people moving in. I mean, you've got to remember that, you know, before the 1950s, basically everyone traveled by train, you know, to go from, you know, city to city. Certainly automobiles were, you know, still were growing. Airlines were growing, but it wasn't, you know, like today where if you're going to another city, you fly, you know, or take a car. The railroads were still the dominant form of transportation. So anyone going anywhere in the first half of the 20th century have a memory of Union Station.
You know, and what's interesting going through your book again is the sense of just how many notable people and not so notable people passed through that station, as you're pointing out. I mean, Harry Truman and lots of other people, too. Who else?
Well, you think about it, Union Station, one of the great things about the history of it is we're used to now kind of shopping malls and strip malls and things like that. When Union Station was built in 1914, it was really like one of the first malls. It had a barber shop, it had a candy store, it had a bookstore.
Drugstore. Yeah.
It had all that kind of stuff. The other thing is, because it was kind of the, you know, transportation center, it was also kind of almost like a scene for paparazzi. And so, you know, people coming through Kansas City, they came through Kansas City and stopped when they were going from coast to coast. So you had like politicians on campaigns that would stop in Kansas City. Every president from Wilson through FDR stopped. And, of course, Truman obviously coming through here. But you also had Hollywood starlets. And so, you know, people I talked to and who wrote me letters who used to be Harvey girls at the Harvey restaurant, Fred Harvey restaurant, which is a famous restaurant in the station, you know, they served Clark Gable. And they served, you know, there are pictures. There was a guy who I talked to who was a who sold books down on the train platforms. And he kept a little autograph book. And he got like Babe Ruth's autograph. Wow. Wow. And he got, you know, all kinds of, you know, other stars' autographs. There's a picture that I think the Kansas City Public Library has of Jeanne Harlow standing in front of the station in the 1920s with her mom and grandma. You know, they had just, you know, were just coming through. And so it was, you know, as they say, the newspapers back then, several of them, you know, the Star, the Times, the Post, they would have photographers that camped out there and would take pictures of any celebrities coming through. And it's much of, it's almost like what you see on TMZ now, because there were pictures of these starlets, you know, walking off the train with their head down, you know, like, don't take a picture of me, I just came off the train, and, you know, stuff like that. So it was...
We're talking about Jeff Spivak, about the history of Union Station. Let's go back a few years, Jeff, into the 80s and 90s. How close did Kansas City come to, you know, to not refurbishing the station at all and sort of just letting it go?
Well, would it have been, I mean, demolished? I mean, there was a, you know, talk at some point in the 80s that, you know, even a, you know, famed architecture critic at the Star called for the demolition of Union Station.
Wow.
And there were some folks that thought it should be demolished. I don't think it ever got that close, but it was closed for, you know, the last tenants moved out in 1989, and the by-state vote was 1996. And
so in those early 90s years, the place is simply abandoned.
It was pretty much abandoned even before the last tenants went out. I mean, there was, you know, Amtrak moved out in the mid-80s. So there was a period there of 4 or 5 years where there was just the Lobster Pot and Colony Steakhouse restaurant there.
Wow.
One restaurant in the whole building. But, you know, the history of the station is filled with ideas and schemes and different concepts that different civic leaders, different organizations came up with to try to reuse the station. None of them ever stuck. I mean, going back, the Chamber of Commerce first had a study in the early 1960s because train travel was really declining then, and people could see what's going to happen to the station. Nothing came of any of the ideas until, you know, the by-state vote in 1996. And the germination of that was basically the end of a lawsuit that Kansas City had. And they turned over the station to a nonprofit group that then was kind of outside the city government. And so the suburban communities kind of felt kind of they had more interest then in getting involved in saving the station than if it was controlled by the Kansas City, Missouri government.
Wow. Well, today, as you know, the building is largely an office park. I mean, that wasn't the vision when the station was refurbished back in the 90s. I mean, do you think this all amounts to something of a disappointment, or is it something that's just the opposite of that, given the financial success the station is enjoying now?
Oh, I think it's definitely the opposite.
I mean,
the Union Station, you know, as I wrote in the book, and its history has shown, it has had a history that is filled with crises. And one crisis that immediately popped up after it reopened was that Science City, which was the main tenant, could not support the station. It was, you know, believed, and at least, you know, budget forecasts that they had back then showed that it would generate enough traffic to help pay the bills. I mean, it costs, at least back then, $500,000 to heat and cool that building. I mean, so you have to really come up with a lot of money to, I mean, it's kind of like anyone's house, except a much bigger house, that, you know, you have to have a lot more funds to take care of that building. And Science City just wasn't able to do it. So, you know, the station reopened with an endowment. The first few years, they kept digging into that endowment and, you know, kind of drawing it down to almost nothing. So the fact that they now have a different strategy that has worked and is now causing the station to turn a profit should be, you know, rejoiced by everyone.
Again, our topic today, Union Station, your memories of Union Station, welcome. Just give us a call, 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888. We're talking with Jeff Spivak about his book on Union Station. And Jeff will be speaking this Sunday, the 28th, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon at the Central Library, the Kansas City Public Library System, as part of the Missouri Valley Sunday series. You can RSVP to grab a seat. Just go to KC Library. library.org. Well, the Union Station that we see today, Jeff, I mean, wasn't Kansas City's original train station, even though it's 100 years old. What was the original station?
Well, the original station was called Union Depot, mm-hmm. and it was down in the West Bottoms. And as you alluded to at the beginning of the show, the flood of 1903 basically shut down that station. And again, back in those days, the turn of the 20th century, train travel dominated for anyone going anywhere. So to have the train station out of commission would be sort of like, you know, today if KCI was, you know, out of commission for, you know, weeks at a time or several days. And so the train station was down there basically in a floodplain. And was overcrowded as the city grew and, you know, was burgeoning through the 1880s and the turn of the 20th century. They needed a bigger building. Now, it's called Union Station because it was owned by a union or a consortium of railroads. And back then, there were a dozen of them.
Yeah, I saw that in your book. I was like, well, that's why it's named Union Station. Yeah. I didn't realize that.
Well, I mean, you know, they're called the big train stations are called Union Stations in just about every major city, mm-hmm. Washington, D.C., Chicago,
right.
you know, because, you know, kind of railroads co-owned them together as opposed to one of them, you know, or two of them trying to build a big monumental station and then, you know, charging lease rates or whatever to the rest of them. So they all collaborated to build them, and they built these monumental structures as a show of force of the railroads. We are the biggest, baddest, you know, industry.
Game in town, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, and is the building down in the river, in the West Bottoms? It's not there any longer,
no,
right?
No, it was demolished right around the time that Union Station opened in 1914.
And what a shame, because that was an amazing building in and of itself.
Well, it was amazing architecturally. I mean, it was like a lot of things in the, kind of that Victorian era. It had, you know, a lot of architectural ornamentation.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing about, I mean, that building and the transition is that actually the railroads, again, there was 12 of them, so it was hard for, you know, to get a, you know, unanimity mm-hmm. basically among those. So there was a split among the 12 railroads. Some of them wanted to put the station over on the north, on the banks of the Missouri River, kind of north and east of today's River Market,
mm-hmm.
kind of where Berkeley Riverfront Park is,
wow.
kind of a little bit around there.
So right down by the river.
So right down by the river. And then another faction won the, what was called the South Site, which was, you know, where it is today. Basically, back at the turn of the 20th century, there wasn't much built. You know, it was sprawl. I mean, where Union Station is today, there wasn't much there. And as it turned out, I mean, the North Site, they wanted it because of a couple of the railroads. Their railroad tracks went right by there.
Wow.
So, you know, it'd be much more convenient for them. And what it came down to is the Armors, the meatpacking company, which was gigantic back at the turn of the 20th century, owned that land. And the railroads were willing and, you know, waiting for a price to buy that land and build the station there. The Armor people came and demanded a price, which was three times higher than the railroads wanted to pay.
Wow.
So that kind of turned the tide, and that's why Union Station is where it is today.
But what a great sight that would have been to have it where Berkeley Riverfront Park is today.
Well, it would have been, you know, kind of equidistant to downtown.
Yeah.
But it certainly would have changed that whole complexion of that part of downtown.
And before I forget, the original station down in the West Bottoms was located where?
Well, it was the Union Street. So today, I believe Union Street or Union Avenue still exists, but it's right, it was right kind of at the bottom of the bluffs. So right, I mean, it would be south of the haunted houses, but if you stand at Case Park today, you can look down and see the railroad tracks that still kind of go through there diagonally.
Mm-hmm.
And Union Depot was adjacent to those tracks.
Is there anything left of it today?
No,
it completely gone?
It's basically an empty spot still.
Wow. Let's go to some phone calls here as we talk about Union Station 100 years ago. It was built and opened here in Kansas City. Donnie from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
I was wondering if you guys ever try to look into solar or wind power to solar power of the station as far as heating and cooling was concerned.
Solar power for Union Station.
I have not heard of them looking into that at all.
Given how expensive it is to heat that building.
I'm sure it's something that they will, as time goes on, look at, because, you know, solar power is, you know, certainly renewables are increasing in importance.
Yeah. Hey, how close did the city come, Jeff, to placing Union Station in the West Bottoms prior to the flood of 1903?
They didn't come close at all, because back then, kind of the densest part of the city was down in the West Bottoms. Mm-hmm. People lived down there. I mean, people used to have houses on the bluffs. You know, and you can't imagine it now because it's so
steep.
Steep, but I mean, there used to be shacks up there. I mean, the Quality Hill, you know, was kind of the Mission Hills of the day, and so the West Bottoms was filled with, you know, you had the train station, you had saloons, you had people's houses, you had the livestock over by the Livestock Exchange building. So it was really crowded. There really wasn't any room down there to build a bigger station.
Hmm. Let's go to Ben from Leawood. Ben, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Yes, when I was 16 years old, my father was in the Buick business of the Buick dealer in a small town in Nebraska. And he would send me at age 16, all by myself, I'd get the train at Auburn, Nebraska, take it to the Union Station, go to the Power and Light building, get the authorization to pick up the car at the Fairfax plant, and I would drive it back to Nebraska all by myself. I thought I was really hot stuff to be in charge of a brand new Buick all by myself. I had all the we didn't have credit cards in those days, but I had all the money I needed, and it was really a treat. I did this 5 or 6 times in my lifetime during that year when I was 16. After that, I didn't do it anymore. But the pleasant memories of going to Union Station with all the hustle and the bustle that occurred there, getting a taxi, riding to the Power and Light building for a 16-year-old country bumpkin from Tecumseh, Nebraska, it was really something.
I bet it was, Ben.
Comment.
I'm glad
that's
you called.
Comment.
Thank you for the call.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
No charge.
Bye-bye. You know, you're talking here, the impact that Union Station has on people, Jeff. You talk in the book about the enormity of the Great Hall and how it impacts people who walk through it. What did you come across, how that place impacts people when they see it?
Well, it's a symbolic structure of Kansas City now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is, the ceiling is like no other in Kansas City, with all kinds of, you know, ribbons and swirls and the colors,
yeah.
And it's like nothing else. And, you know, you think about it, when you're watching the Chiefs play on TV, Monday Night Football or something, and the national broadcast is showing pictures of Kansas City, they always show Union Station.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, when political campaigns come through town, you know, a lot of times, you know, big events, they're happening at Union Station. You know, the interesting thing is, back in the first part of the 20th century, Union Station was kind of the gathering point for the city at the time. You know, there used to be, you know, the biggest New Year's Eve events used to be under the clock at Union Station.
Yeah.
You know, and now today, some of the biggest kind of community-oriented gatherings, you know, occur at Union Station. There's, you know, when the symphony plays outside for, you know, the general public, they do it at Union Station. You know, when Sporting KC won the championship in December, you know, where'd they hold their, you know, championship rally?
Yeah.
But Union Station.
People have said to you that they feel like they're walking in slow motion as they go through the Great Hall.
Well, it's certainly a place that, you know, can stop time. I mean, as you walk through there, you can't help but look up and around and just at the enormity and the architecture of the place, all the ornamentation, because it's like no other building.
Hey, how similar is Union Station today to what it looked like 100 years ago?
Very, very similar. The
wow.
When it went through the reconstruction in 96, they basically, you know, washed it. I mean, you know, they sandblasted the outside, so the original color came back. Particularly the ceiling today is exactly like what it looked like when it opened. The process that they went through was painstaking.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was historic preservationists that, I mean, they built obviously a gigantic scaffolding to get up there, but they flaked off years and years of grime and paint to get to the original colors and then basically duplicated them. And, I mean, you think about it, and for those that have seen the pictures from the 70s, 80s, 90s, before it reopened, the ceiling had basically turned brown. All the colors, the pinks and yellows and blues, were all gone. And you know, part of it was, you know, back when it opened, the trains that came through were steam engines,
mm-hmm.
and steam would come up and it would, you know, dirty things. And, you know, the ceiling really couldn't be cleaned a lot because it was so high up. And so over the years, it just, you know, got grimy. And then as the station, you know, was closed and going through its hard times, the roof leaked. And, you know, that added to the, you know, kind of issues on the ceiling. But basically, as you walk through there today, it looks just like it did in the, you know, second decade of the 20th century.
Man. You write in your book that the man who gave Union Station its quiet dignity was a man named Jarvis Hunt. Who was Jarvis Hunt?
He was the architect who designed Union Station. And he was kind of from a famous family of architects. And he, for instance, helped design a pavilion at the 1893 World's Fair in Chicago. He was from Chicago, from the city of Wheaton. And he was chosen to be the architect because he had some experience in doing railroad stations, was doing the Joliet, Illinois station, which looks a lot like Union Station in Kansas City, except a miniature version.
Huh.
It's a smaller town.
Yeah.
And he came up with the design. And again, in those days, these buildings were, you know, the desire of the railroads was to be monumental. So, you know, Washington, D.C. station had already been built. And, you know, Jarvis Hunt sort of patterned Kansas City's Union Station after that one, not in terms of the outside design, but in terms of a giant headhouse and then two wings on the, you know, left and right, basically the east and west of it.
How much did it cost?
It cost about the building itself was like $10 million. The
in dollars 100 years ago, obviously.
100 years ago.
Yeah.
Now, the whole complex, which included new train tracks, you know, to connect all the lines going through Kansas City and then, you know, kind of going in and out of town, came to $48 million, which is, in today's dollars, more than $1 billion.
Wow.
And
wow.
So when
you're rerouting tracks, making sure everybody can sort of connect through Kansas City.
Yes.
And the station where it's located.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. Now, you know, 10.6 million, I just looked it up in 1914 dollars, is about a quarter of a billion in today's dollars.
Mm.
The station was redeveloped in 1996, reopened 1999 for basically a quarter of $1 billion. So it cost as much to refurbish as it did to build new.
Can you buy tickets and take any trains from Union Station today? How does it work?
Yeah, Amtrak still goes out of the station.
Yeah.
And so you can still take a train out
of it. It's the last vestige of passenger travel.
Basically. And, you know, it actually railroads are coming back to some degree right now as, you know, train travel becomes more laborious, or excuse me, airlines become more laborious.
Tell
you have to get
it.
There an hour,
tell
you know, ahead of time, go through security, and you don't have to do that at trains. And, you know, the federal government's putting money into high-speed rail, which, you know, could or could not come to fruition, but, you know, could be 50 years from now, train travel is a, you know, a big deal again.
You know, and the fact that this community, the metro area, came together in the mid-90s to pass the bi-state tax was something of a miracle in and of itself, given the complexities of the legislation and given the fact that both Missouri and Kansas, the legislatures there, had to sign off on this thing. It was a heck of a process.
Oh, it took a long time, too, because first they had to get, as you mentioned, legislation from both Missouri and Kansas. And sometimes one would pass, you know, the legislation and change the language.
Yeah.
So then it would have to go to the other one, and they changed some language. And it went back and forth, you know, for a number of years in the 80s. You know, finally was consolidated. And then as the bi-state effort really, you know, started ramping up in 1994, 95, you know, there was some talk that, you know, the Kansas legislature in particular was going to repeal the bi-state legislation, so you mm-hmm. couldn't have a metro-wide vote. But obviously it was historic, and you know from your political reporting, that campaign also had basically the perfect candidate. I mean, Union Station,
yeah.
they opened it up, in its dilapidated state for tours. People came by in droves just to see the station, to basically look at the ruin. And, I mean, Union Station sat there. It couldn't talk. It couldn't make any mistakes.
It didn't have to see.
It didn't have to. You know, and, you know, all it had to do was, you know, sit there and look dilapidated. And people felt sorry for it and had all these, you know, flood of memories. And, that historic vote, it passed in a landslide, 60% to 40% in 4 out of the 5 counties.
I was going to ask you what the final vote was, 60%.
Yeah.
You know, are there sort of hidden places in Union Station, catacombs, underground walkways, hidden places in a building that large? I always think there's got to be some pretty cool out-of-sight kinds of places that the public doesn't typically see.
Well, there used to be in the basement.
Yeah.
They had 2 levels of basement. And but since it reopened, it's they've put some exhibits down there, and they've kind of redone the basement level, even putting some offices down there. But back when it was being rebuilt and renovated, you would go down there, and there used to be, you know, the engine room where, you know, elevators and the heating and cooling systems were. And there were people that claimed there were ghosts down there. And and basically there was also down in that basement a long, long tunnel that connected Union Station to the post office, which was across the street to the west, basically the southwest.
Yeah.
You know, a good walk away from Union Station, but there was a tunnel down there, and that's how they would, deliver and get mail to and from the post office that would be coming off the trains. They would take it down there. Wow. And then go through this long 1/4 mile tunnel to get to the post office.
Is that tunnel gone now?
I do not know, but it's been blocked off.
Yeah,
you know, a number of years ago it was that. I mean, you can't go down there and walk all the way. And that building now has, you know, been torn down, and, you know, it's where the IRS is now.
Who were the champions of the cause to restore Union Station and bring it back again? Who would you point to?
There were many.
Many.
I mean, Emanuel Cleaver was mayor at the time. You know, he gets credit for ending the lawsuit with Trizac, which was a Canadian development firm which had promised to redevelop the station and never did anything. And it was one of those things, how do you, you know, get out from under that development contract and let someone else take over.
Yeah.
You know, he gets credit for basically finally resolving the lawsuit with Trizac. And then there were suburbanites that really stepped up. And again, this was a metropolitan effort which hadn't been done before or
mm-hmm.
since,
mm-hmm.
Ranging from Bill Esri, the former chairman of Sprint,
yeah.
who headed up a project committee that kind of oversaw the redevelopment, Lou Smith, who was with Allied Signal, and then and then the Kaufman Foundation retired.
Yeah.
He
yeah.
was another one, and even Steve Rose, mm-hmm. who was publisher of the Stars,
the Sun. Yeah.
competitor, the Sun newspaper in Johnson County, and he teamed up with Jack Kraft,
mm-hmm.
an attorney in Kansas City, to basically lead the campaign committees for Bi-State. So you had someone in Kansas and someone in Missouri.
We're going to leave our conversation there. Again, Jeff Spivak speaks this Sunday at 2 o'clock at the Central Library downtown as part of the Missouri Valley's Sunday series. You can RSVP to grab a seat. Just go to kclibrary.org. And so good to have you, Jeff. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
You bet.